It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up later in the program, a visit with two Holocaust survivors who live just blocks from the Tree of Life Synagogue. They say they weren't surprised the community was targeted. And we'll talk with the host of the popular Jewish podcast, Unorthodox, who marveled at the Jewish community here and the city as a whole. But first, Pittsburgh's leaders like to tout new developments sprouting up here and there and the jobs they could create. But how much emphasis is placed on making those developments strong for the economy, yet sustainable, inclusive, and even healthy for the community? Joylette Portlock was named last week as the new executive director of Sustainable Pittsburgh and will begin that post in December. Joylette, welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
So Sustainable Pittsburgh, a nonprofit, recently marked 20 years, its 20th anniversary, and at the beginning had a bit of a daunting task. First of all, explaining the concept of sustainability. Would you say now that most sectors of our community agree on what sustainability means to the region and specifically?
Well, I mean, I think that sustainability has a couple of different definitions depending on who you're talking to, right? Sometimes that definition revolves around purely the economics of the situation of a business venture or something like that. But I think our approach and definition at Sustainable Pittsburgh is broader than that. It doesn't just include economic success, but also does rest on these ideas of inclusion, of environmental health, and of really a sustainability of a whole society perspective.
So how do you mesh those definitions, those understandings, when you are trying to partner with different organizations, with companies, with individuals? How do you do that to come to some sort of agreement that here's what it really means and here's how it impacts our community?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that that really comes out of a collaborative conversation. I don't think the goals are at odds in any way. I think that the economic success and the environmental health and this notion that you really want to build things in a way that can keep going for all the people and can produce a thriving environment. I mean, those are entirely compatible. So it's about finding that space and making sure those issues are all at the forefront.
You mentioned compatible. It seemed like for a while, and I don't know how far back it goes, it seemed like there was at least a perception that it was economy or sustainability.
Yeah, that's true. I'd like to think that we've moved from that place. I think many organizations of all kinds, obviously in the nonprofit community and in the community development spheres, but as well in the for-profit community, are starting to really understand that environmental sustainability and economic sustainability are inherently entangled. They're not things you can separate. So right. I think we're getting there.
You are succeeding the founding executive director, Court Gold, who accepted another position elsewhere up in Erie earlier this year. So where is Sustainable Pittsburgh now and where do you want to take it?
Well, those are two great questions. I think Sustainable Pittsburgh is in a really wonderful place. I mean, for 20 years, it's been doing this work and has really, really built up a suite of really important programs around sustainability performance in the for-profit world, and has pushed forward on some professional development initiatives and has done a lot of great collaborations on regional policy initiatives, and is starting to expand into the space of this a community development sphere, working with municipalities and communities on more sustainable practices. So I really think there's an incredible body of programs, and it's a strong organization with a track record of success and a lot of potential. So where I want to take it, that's less defined at this juncture. I haven't actually started yet. So first most important job there is really going to be to talk with the very talented and dedicated staff and the engaged and enthusiastic members of the board who also have a lot of expertise in all of this, and explore the space of what's possible. I mean, I do, of course, have ideas, but, right. you know, I'd like to be able to and talk with all the stakeholders that are involved. I mean, there are many, many organizations that Sustainable Pittsburgh has partnered with over time. So I think all of those voices and ideas are going to be really important to sort of chart this next step.
Right. So would you give us an example or two of sort of accomplishments, realizing you haven't, but you've kept an you have kept an eye on what Sustainable Pittsburgh's doing. But in the sense of, are we talking, oh, do all things have to be major changes, or can there be small increments or small adjustments in a development with a company or another stakeholder?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that, well, it's interesting. I think that big changes obviously are very important and are very much needed. But often small changes to start on that path are also very important and sometimes harder than the big changes in certain contexts, right? I think, you know, what we're really after when we talk about sustainability is a shift in our cultural mindset around incorporating these ideas at the ground level when we're starting to plan or starting to do this work. So I think that some of Sustainable Pittsburgh's accomplishments over time, convening groups of people, such as the CEOs for Sustainability Executive Council group, which has met and talked about, really tried to create a sort of community of learning, community of practice among the for-profit community, and how to do this work has been really successful. And a lot of people will know about the Sustainable Pittsburgh Restaurant Program,
right.
And things like that to introduce sustainability into that sector. So I think there are definitely examples out there of work Sustainable Pittsburgh has done.
So you're leaving Carnegie Museum, Associate Director of Science Research, previously worked for the Climate Reality Project and also for Penn Future, the statewide environmental advocacy group. How might those experiences sort of inform how you want to involve Sustainable Pittsburgh?
Well, I think that all of those experiences have been really wonderful opportunities for me, and also have really informed me about a lot of different ideas for doing kind of the same work. You know, I mentioned earlier this shift in cultural mindset, right? And so all of this work is really around how do we incorporate these ideas into the types of things that we're doing. So for me right now, especially coming most directly from the museum, but also through my work at Communitopia and at Penn Future and all these other organizations, I think it's really critically important that we start building community around these topics. And I don't just mean, you know, people in neighborhoods talking to one another, although that's an important piece of this, but I mean communities between the for-profit and nonprofit communities, communities where decision makers and leaders are talking to one another and kind of building support for more sustainable practices going forward.
Sustainable Pittsburgh, you mentioned at its core, it's a convener bringing together diverse entities, engaging people. But this means all people, all stakeholders. Have some stakeholders, do you think, gotten ignored, whether they're in low income or minority communities when developments were put into place? And there's where the equitable factor comes into play.
Right. And I did mention before that, you know, equity is a core tenet of sustainability. Yes. I mean, I think that over time, we see time and time again that often people are left out of the conversations and don't have seats at the table that really should. We really do need to do a better and more intentional job of seeking out diverse perspectives and making sure that all the stakeholders are included in the conversation.
Okay. So personally, while you were studying, I believe, biology and anthropology at MIT.
Correct.
And later getting your PhD in genetics at Stanford.
Yes.
So was leading an environmental organization on your future goals list?
It really wasn't. although, you know, even during my doctoral work, it was clear to me that I wanted to be in more of this space between, in this communication space of right. talking to the public and trying to improve public awareness about some pretty complex subjects. Because there are many things where I feel like that translation effort is very much needed, especially by people with technical training who can read the manuals and the scientific journals and make some sense of it for people who need the information.
Well, we have just about the 30 seconds or so left. So next chapter for Sustainable Pittsburgh as you begin your term as executive director in early December.
Yep, that's right. It's very exciting, and I'm very much looking forward to it. I think that the organization's next phase is going to be, I think its first phase has been wonderful and very impactful, and I'm looking forward to helping to shape the next phase, which I think will be also very exciting and worthwhile for the entire community.
Joylette Portlock is the new executive director of Sustainable Pittsburgh. She begins that post in December. Thanks so much for joining us, Joylette.
Thank you again for having me.
And you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Pharrell Williams, the singer behind the song Happy, is asking President Trump not to use that song ever again. That's after the song played at an event Trump appeared at on Saturday, the same day that 11 people were killed at the Tree of Life Synagogue. And the 911 operators who responded to the calls Saturday recount a day that they hoped would never come. For the dispatcher who took the first call, it was just her fifth week of training. Find her story and others at our website at wesa.fm.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. In Washington, D.C., Democrats hope a blue wave Tuesday will sweep them into control of the U.S. House. Keystone Crossroads contributor Jim Saxa reports in Harrisburg, Democrats only expect a blue ripple will hit the General Assembly.
Tina Davis is impatient. The Democratic candidate for state Senate here in Lower Bucks County has knocked on 60,000 doors so far, but there's thousands more to go before Election Day. And on this cold and windy Sunday, she can't let a reporter slow her down.
Do you walk that slow?
Davis sees a virtue in that impatience, though. They could use more of that urgency in Harrisburg, where, she argues, the GOP is slowing everything down.
Well, I got the Recovery House bill through. It took me four
years.
That was big for our area.
It is a big deal.
It took me a long time.
It
shouldn't happen. Shouldn't have taken 4 years.
No, it shouldn't have. Absolutely right. Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
And thank you.
If Democrats have any hope of making gains in the Pennsylvania State Senate, they need Davis to win this race against longtime Republican incumbent Tommy Tomlinson. Registered Democrats outnumber Republicans in the district, which also backed Hillary Clinton in 2016. But Davis is an underdog, which speaks to the GOP's long reign over the General Assembly. Here's Terry Madonna, director of the Franklin and Marshall poll.
The state Senate in Pennsylvania, except for one 16-month period back in the early 1990s, has been in Republican Party hands since 1980.
Statewide, registered Democrats outnumber Republicans by more than 800,000, and they've easily won the last few statewide races like attorney general and governor. But the GOP currently holds a 2-to-1 advantage in the state Senate, and they dominate the state House, too. So what gives? Why the big disconnect between how Democrats do statewide and how they do in state legislative races? Some like to blame this imbalance on gerrymandering, but Republican political consultant Christopher Nicholas doesn't buy that.
Nine Republican senators represent districts with more registered Democrats than Republicans. No Democrat represents a district with more Republicans. So the answer is that Republicans have figured out how to win seats where there are registered Democrats never have.
The Senate would be evenly split if Democrats controlled those nine seats. But despite the apparent registration advantage, sources say Democrats haven't tried very hard to win these districts. Heck, in one of these, in Allegheny County, they didn't even run a candidate in 2014. Larry Seisler is a political analyst and a Democrat. He mostly agrees with Nicholas. It's not that the Republicans imposed the gerrymandered map, Seisler says. It's that many of the Democrats in Harrisburg were happy to go along with it.
Their incumbents wanted to have safe seats, and many of them really didn't care where they were in the majority or the minority. Basically, they wanted to pick up a paycheck. So they cut themselves safe seats to the detriment of the party gaining the majority.
Meanwhile,
Republicans seem to be better at running these races than Democrats are. They put more resources into the races, probably more professionalism.
Things might be different this year, though. Across the U.S., polls show more Democrats than Republicans are eager to vote in the midterms, and they've raised more money. But in Pennsylvania, no neutral observer thinks Democrats can retake either chamber of the legislature. Still, if Democrats like Tina Davis can manage to win races like the 6th Senate District, they might get close. Later that Sunday, Davis throws a rally for her volunteers at Bailey's Bar and Grill. There's free food and beer, and the Eagles are on every TV. About 3 dozen people show up, including Brian Maskey.
The government doesn't function. It just doesn't function.
It's voters like Maskey that Davis and Democrats across the state are hoping to win over moderate Republicans.
Number one, I've been a Republican since I was 18 years old, and their performance over the last 6-7 years has just driven me away from them.
Maskey says he's an independent now. He votes for people willing to work with the other party.
I think we need more of that. And Tina is definitely one that would be that type of representative in the Senate.
If Davis can convince a few more Republicans to follow his example, she just might eke out ahead on November 6th. Jim Saxa, Keystone Crossroads.
You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Holocaust survivors Moshe Baron and Sam Gottesman live on the same floor of a Squirrel Hill apartment building just 5 blocks from the Tree of Life Synagogue. The two men say that, sadly, they were not surprised that the community was targeted. For The Confluence, reporter Reed Fraser sat down with them to get their reactions to what's being called the deadliest attack on Jews in American history.
Behind a bureau in Sam Gottesman's Squirrel Hill apartment is a collage of photos from his life. There are pictures of family gatherings, his wedding, and some black and white photos of people in prison uniforms.
This is the liberation in Hanover, the camp, the background. This is another picture of us taken by the U.S. Army.
Gottesman was born in 1923. In the former Czechoslovakia. He survived. Most of his family did not. One day, they were evicted from the ghetto they were living in and sent on a train to Auschwitz. When they got off the train, he went with other able-bodied men in one direction.
And then we saw the elderly, the women with the children on the other side. They were ordered to walk somewhere. That was the last time we saw our families.
Gottesman was shipped to a series of work camps and later was liberated by American troops. Eventually, he came to Pittsburgh. He was at synagogue last Saturday morning when news of a shooting at a different temple, the Tree of Life, raced through the building.
So it was right away known as that something happened. We didn't know details.
But soon enough, the details would come through. 11 dead, shot by a man who said he wanted to kill Jews. Gottesman wasn't shocked that something like this could happen here.
Wherever there is still people who are going around killing, who have taken upon themselves the right to say who lives and who doesn't live. So what has changed?
Down the hall from Gottesman lives another Holocaust survivor, Moshe Baron. He too was at synagogue when he heard about the shooting at Tree of Life.
But there are no words. You can't describe when you feel something like that. It happened right around the corner from you.
During World War II, Baron managed to escape a Nazi work camp and joined a group called the Jewish Partisans. They were resistance fighters that lived in the forests of what is now Belarus. They fought Nazis and saved as many Jews as they could.
I used the occasion to bring out my family. First, my brother and sister from the ghetto, and then my mother.
But he couldn't save his father or another sister of his. One day, they and the 900 other Jews from his village were evicted from their homes and forced to march.
So I always imagine my father holding my little sister's hand. I'm not sure he knew where we were going, but they were going, and 10 minutes later, they were gone. They were finished.
Baron says soldiers gunned them down from behind. He survived the war, and after being drafted into the Soviet Army, eventually made his way to America. He's lived in Pittsburgh since 1993. He said he wasn't surprised there were still pockets of poison, as he called it, in the U.S.
You know, I am foolproof. You know what it is? I have gotten a lot of shocks in my life.
Baron turns 98 next month and still speaks publicly about his experiences in the Holocaust. I asked what he thought about the rise of Holocaust denial, a common thread in the far-right anti-Semitism the alleged gunman, Robert Bowers, was a part of.
Disgusting. And somebody here is going to tell me it didn't happen. It didn't happen. But where's my father? Where's my sister? Where's my grandmother? Where are my uncles and cousins?
So what would Moshe Baron do with Bowers? Bowers posted hate online for the Jews because he said they helped refugees, and he called refugees hostile invaders. Would he sentence Bowers to death? He thinks about it for a moment.
I would like them to see people helping people. And if they didn't like refugees, I would like them to see people coming here and settling down. I would like to punish them with let them see what they didn't want to see. This would be my punishment.
For The Confluence, I'm Reed Frazier.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. A production team from the popular Jewish podcast Unorthodox is now back in New York after coming to Pittsburgh to report on one of the worst anti-Semitic attacks in our nation's history, the mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue. Stephanie Butnick is the host of the podcast Unorthodox. Stephanie, why did you feel the need to come immediately to Pittsburgh after you heard the news?
So Unorthodox is produced by Tablet Magazine, which is an online Jewish news and culture publication. And by Saturday, you know, within an hour of finding out what had happened, our editor-in-chief, Alana Newhouse, had just said, "We're going to Pittsburgh. Whoever can come, please come." And so that included us on the podcast team. And we all, you know, on Sunday morning, we got in the car at 6 a.m. and drove and got to Pittsburgh, went straight to the JCC, then from there to the vigil, and then, you know, just tried to talk to people. So essentially, it was sort of pretty obvious that we needed to be here, that we needed to go to Pittsburgh and just to offer whatever we could journalistically, personally, you know, just to be there as this tragedy unfolded.
Media outlets all around the world are reporting on this story. What was your goal in terms of what you could contribute to the overall conversation?
So it's interesting. So Tablet sent reporters who are on the ground, you know, doing sort of more straight news stories. And what we wanted to do as a podcast was basically say, you know, let's tell this story through audio, through the voices of the people here. Let's really show a portrait of Pittsburgh, and particularly Squirrel Hill, you know, the sort of Jewish enclave where this happened. And we had been, you know, everyone I think had been glued to the news, everyone who was affected by this or you know, the whole country I think was sort of glued to what was happening. But what we wanted to show was actually the uniqueness of Pittsburgh's Jewish community, which we knew about because we, you know, knew people from there. And it's different from a lot of other Jewish communities. So the idea of our podcast episode, which went live, I believe, Monday night, was to show essentially a snapshot of a very unique and very tight-knit Jewish community that I don't think you could get necessarily in a print article. We sort of thought audio would be the medium to really, really, you know, we barely talk on this episode. It's really just voices of Pittsburgh.
I have to ask, you said different. So in what ways is the Jewish community of Squirrel Hill different from other places?
So it's interesting. Pittsburgh's obviously a big city, but the Jewish community really does have a small town feel. A lot of the people we spoke to were second, third, fourth, even fifth generation Pittsburghers. And I think that's what makes this tragedy so horrific, is that everyone in that town, everyone in the Jewish community knew was affected by this because they knew someone, and because everyone is so nice and so caring and so involved. And another way the Jewish community is different is that typically in Jewish communities, there's different synagogues, right? There's Reform congregations, Conservative, Orthodox, and those are the main three denominations. And you go to one synagogue, and you really don't go to other synagogues unless you have a bar mitzvah there or a wedding there. You don't necessarily step into them. But what we found in Pittsburgh was that Jewish people belong to several congregations. You know, you like one rabbi here, and you also really like, you know, a minion over here. And so you sort of dabble. You pick and choose what you want to do. And in that way, the community is really engaged with each other. You know, you might go to a Reform synagogue one day and a Conservative the next week. And that is unusual among Jewish populations. And it meant that there is a close-knit sense of, you know, obviously these distinctions exist, right? There are different congregations, but there really was a sense that everyone was in it together and a real collaborative sense of a Jewish identity there.
It sounds like you're describing something that is close-knit because of those relationships.
Yeah, and that is, you know, it's interesting to see this community. It was really amazing to see this community. They really snapped into action. You know, we were based at the JCC, and all of a sudden, the JCC is hosting funerals and shivas, and it's the same staff of, you know, these people who work at a Jewish community center. Suddenly, everyone has just picked up these new roles as you know, keepers of these people's legacies and of help of supporting each other. The people I saw just hug each other and cry. I mean, it was this community coming together, and it was an unbelievable thing to see amidst such tragedy. Just these people embracing each other and being there and supporting each other to move forward.
Stephanie, listening to your podcast, I heard so many voices, so many. Who stands out to you? Maybe that family who actually fled France from the violence, came to the Pittsburgh area, and then found it here?
That really was one of the most amazing stories we heard. It was of a man and his wife and their young children who they're both French, and they had come, you know, sort of went back and forth, but they were raising their kids in Paris. And after the horrific anti-Semitic attacks 2 years ago, they sort of said, we have to leave. It's time to go. And his father had actually gotten this really amazing position at the hospital there. And so he said, you know, let's go to Pittsburgh. So they sort of end up, this French family in Pittsburgh. And then this happens. It was amazing to talk to him because what he said was, it's the same feeling, right? When something like this happens, he says the difference is the response. He's like, I've never seen anything in Paris like what I saw in the past few days in Pittsburgh. The community coming together, the wider community, this just outpouring of love and support. He said that's what made this feel different.
Your podcast usually seems to focus on lighter topics, including Jewish art and culture. This, of course, was much, much more serious. Personally, how difficult was it for you and your team?
This is a very different thing for us. And it felt really important to sort of say, we're here for our community of listeners. We have amazing listeners. We have this very, very, very active Facebook page. It's a private Facebook group that people join. And what people were saying was, you know, they didn't even know we were on the way to Pittsburgh. They said, I need to hear from Unorthodox. I need to hear from you guys. And someone said, you know, the first thing I did was check CNN. The second thing I did was come to this Facebook group. And so we realized we actually owe it to our listeners who come to us, yes, for fun and silly sometimes content on Jewish stories and Jewish celebrities, but what we actually are to them is a Jewish space, is a safe Jewish space. And so when something like this happens, our listeners did turn to us, and I'm so happy that we were able to be there and to give them this. Because, you know, if you're not in Pittsburgh, if you're not from Pittsburgh, this is a horrific thing that happened, and it's awful, but it's hard to get context, and it's hard to understand, and you could read all the news articles in the world about it. But what I think we did, and what I'm so proud that we did, is just turn the mics over to the people and to hear them and to hear, you know, snippets from the vigil, to hear, you know, Pittsburgh resident Lou Weiss read his Wall Street Journal article. To hear it, I think, gave a connection to our listeners so that they could feel like they were, if not there themselves, because, you know, not everyone can get there and can show their support in that way, but that they were connected to this tragedy somehow and that they could understand what it would be like to live in that place.
Final question, Stephanie. You're now back in New York. What were you feeling when you left Pittsburgh? Did you feel bolstered by the resilient spirit of the people you met? Were you sad? What was it?
I've been so moved for the past few days that I've been in Pittsburgh. I almost can't believe these people, that they are enduring such tragedy with such poise and such grace and such hospitality. Every single person I talked to, including people I, you know, shoved a microphone in their face at a vigil for people that they knew, every single person at the end of our interview said, "Where do you have a place to stay while you're here? Do you need anything? Can I help you?" And this outrageous hospitality that was extended to us in such a dark time for every single person there was something that moved me really, really profoundly. And just the way that, you know, this wasn't just a fun visit to Pittsburgh. This was under the worst circumstances. And these people still, you know, invited me into their homes. They fed us. They kept asking how we were doing. It was an unbelievable thing. And I think I learned a lot about community and what it means to be proud of your community and to be active and to give, you know, not just money, but time, and to invest yourself in your community, whether that's a religious community or otherwise. And, you know, when I got on the plane this morning, I was sad to be leaving. I knew I had to get back to my regular life, to my work here, but it was sad to leave. And that was strange to me. And the interesting thing is, as a journalist, you go in and you sort of have a bit of distance, right? Because you need to be objective. And even for us, we put together a very emotional and deeply, I hope, moving show. But you still, you know, you're on the other side of it, right? You're holding the microphone out. You're getting the audio. You're worried about uploading the files. It gives you a little bit of distance from, you know, what was a I keep saying the word horrific, but I actually don't know another word for this. You know, you don't entirely have to engage emotionally. And so I think I will be doing that in the days and weeks to come. So I'm, you know, it feels strange to be back in New York City. I feel like I still should be in Pittsburgh in some way.
Stephanie Butnick is the host of the popular Jewish podcast, Unorthodox. Stephanie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. NPR's David Green spent several of his childhood years in Pittsburgh, and while he hasn't lived here in many years, he still has strong ties to our city and will always be a Pittsburgher at heart. David, was that heart aching over the last several days since the mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue?
It was aching beyond belief. I mean, I've had the city in my thoughts and prayers. Tree of Life is a neighborhood I know really well. I grew up in Shadyside, off Walnut Street, and my dad lived in Squirrel Hill, right by Carnegie Mellon. And one of the victims, Joyce Feinberg, actually worked at Pitt, at the Learning Research and Development Center. And when I read that on the air, it was the first moment I realized that, you know, she worked alongside my mother in the same building and same office. And, you know, I lost my mom years ago, but I'm sure they shared a lot and knew a lot of the same people. So yeah, I feel like we've been seeing, at least from afar, Kevin, the best of Pittsburgh come out in this tragedy. But yeah, I've haven't stopped thinking about what happened and hoping that the city is doing okay.
What's it like to cover something from a national perspective that happened in a place that you have so many fond memories of?
It's really weird because, you know, unfortunately, I've had to cover so many of these. You know, I was in Paris after the attack there. I was in Orlando after the attack at the Pulse nightclub. And as painful as it was to watch communities go through that, there was some level of disconnect, I feel like, and I could actually handle the story as a journalist. This one, you know, just reading the names of the victims and reading about the neighborhood and you know, introducing people to Squirrel Hill on the air and reading intros for stories about Squirrel Hill, but knowing so much about it, I don't know. It felt like I was in this weird space between being a journalist but also being a Pittsburgher at heart and feeling the pain of the city. So it was just a very different and strange experience.
David, you referenced this a little earlier. So from a distance, what has been your impression to how Pittsburgh has sort of responded?
I mean, you're just seeing the best of the city and how tight-knit it is and how people care for each other and care about, you know, neighbors. I mean, it's just been so heartening, I think. And it's also been really gratifying to watch outsiders who don't know much about the city be impressed by the resilience. I mean, I've had people who don't even know I'm from Pittsburgh talking about, you know, religious leaders from all different faiths and how they watched the vigil and, you know, are raising different religions, raising money for each other and standing by Tree of Life. And it's the best of our city coming out. And it's horrible that it had to happen this way. But I think a lot of the country is seeing what Pittsburgh is all about, which is a nice thing.
One of the rabbis that we had on the air related a story, and he was asked, well, how are you doing, Rabbi? And he said, well, I was parking my car, pulling up to talk to a member of my congregation, and a woman was parking nearby, and she came up to me and asked, are you Jewish? And he said, yes, I am. And she goes, I just have to give you a hug.
I think we could all give Squirrel Hill a hug right now.
So listeners to our regular conversations, I mean, they'll know that about your connection to Pittsburgh and your ongoing fandom for sports. It's interesting. So the moments of silence, Penguins held a blood drive. They donated special game-worn jerseys for an auction to benefit the families of the victims and the wounded officers. And two busloads of Steelers also attended the funeral of the two brothers who were killed. Is this what you expect from Pittsburgh sports?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I moved to the city in 1980, and the story I always heard about the Steelers and all Pittsburgh sports was that they always lifted up Pittsburgh in the hardest times. And seeing that now, it's exactly what I would expect. You know, it's our sports are one thing that just it we're always together. I mean, we rise and fall with those teams. And I think, you know, we celebrate together like a family when they're doing well. Our hearts are broken when they're not doing well. And so it's built into us to come together as a family around those teams. And so in a moment like this, I mean, of course, the city would sort of use sports to heal. And listening to Mike Tomlin talk about living in Squirrel Hill and Cam Hayward and how that neighborhood means so much to him, and even Andrew McCutchen from afar, you know, just, you know, he's not a Pirate anymore, but it's his city, and watching him respond so quickly, you just realize how much those teams mean to the city and how much the city means to those teams. So, yeah, it's lovely to see that, but it doesn't surprise me.
David, let's make the next time we talk happier times.
I would really, really like that. And, you know, I wish I could be there healing with the rest of the city, but I'm thinking about you. I'm thinking about everyone at WESA, and I'm thinking about the whole city right now, because this is an unimaginably tough time.
NPR Morning Edition host David Green, and a forever Pittsburgher wherever he lives. David, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin. Take care.
And finally, 1 week ago tomorrow, gunfire shattered the peace at Shabbat services at the Tree of Life Synagogue. Anti-Semitism, hatred turned into horror. 11 Jewish congregants were brutally murdered. The divisive nature of bigotry failed, however. The horrific event created stronger bonds, further united a community, a city. The 11, Joyce Feinberg, Richard Gottfried, Rose Malinger, Jerry Rabinowitz, Cecil and David Rosenthal, Sylvan and Bernice Simon, Daniel Stein, Melvin Wax, and Irving Younger, have been called victims. But they were mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers. They were doctors, researchers, accountants, and coaches. They were friends and neighbors. They were Pittsburghers. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was produced and engineered by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stinelli and Meg Fair. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Peace to us all.